Welcome to the conference room with this week's guest, Kev Ealy.
And then in Europe, in different countries, you have very different tendencies when it comes to purchasing technology. Some parts of Europe, a proof of value or proof of concept is absolutely essential. It's essential that the technicians actually get their hands on the technology and test it.
Welcome to The Conference Room, a weekly podcast where business leaders and growth experts kindly share their experiences, actionable tips, and secrets to successfully grow a business. If you like the podcast, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a five-star review. It'll really help us out. And I really hope you enjoy this week's episode. I'm Simon Lader. Welcome to The Conference Room. Good afternoon, and welcome to The Conference Room. I'm joined by Kev Ealy. Kev has almost 30 years' experience growing technology businesses across EMEA. He spent 5 years with IBM, 9 years with Microsoft before spells at Trapex, Egress Software, and he's now the VP EMEA of cybersecurity titan LogRhythm. And in his spare time, he's an avid sailor. And I'm delighted that we finally managed to coax him into the conference room. So, Kev Ealy, good afternoon and welcome to the conference room.
Good afternoon, Simon, and thank you for having me on the conference room. I'm delighted to be here. Great to speak with you.
It's a genuine pleasure. So, every hero has an origin story, and you're the hero of our story. So tell me, how did you get into this amazing industry and embark on this incredible career that you've had, culminating so far in being VP EMEA of LogRhythm?
So it's a long time ago, Simon. I'm going back in the distant past. So I left university. I was considering what to do next. I was thinking, shall I continue in academia? Believe it or not, my degree was actually in environmental biology, which clearly has a tremendous amount to do with cybersecurity and what I do today.
Right.
But I was very interested in the environment and all things, you know, marine, maritime. There's a theme there in terms of the sailing. So I was thinking about what to do next, and an opportunity came up to join a small organization called IBM. tiny organization. And fascinating period to join IBM in 1995, because in 1993, IBM had suffered what was then the biggest loss in US corporate history. So IBM was going very much through a transformation initiative under the CEO, Lou Gerstner. So fresh-faced, pretty much out of college or university, joined IBM, did not have a clue what was really going on for the first 6 months. It was like being parachuted into a completely different country with a completely different language, massive learning curve, and so forth. But during the first 6 months of working within IBM, I was working in business administration and business support and sales support. I started to interact very closely with the salespeople, and the salespeople would wander into the office and they'd be nicely suited and they'd be wearing nice watches and they'd be driving amazing cars and they'd be waving around their commission checks. And as a 22-year-old, I was sat there wide-eyed thinking, I want to do what they're doing. And so I made a path to do that. And I actually conducted what was probably my first B2B sales call, calling on a sales director in IBM who did not know me, but some of his team knew me, and said, I want to get into sales. And we had a conversation, a discussion. I then went up to meet him and he sponsored me through sales school. And then I moved into the world of IBM sales, selling AS400. So that was my entry point into this world of sales. And wasn't by design, as I won't say in the sense that as a 14 or 15 year old or 16 year old, my mind was set on a career in sales, but from ending up in IT, and from interacting with the salespeople and having an affinity with them and a similar mindset, I suppose, to the salespeople, it drew me in. And then I suppose over time, I recognized and realized that the personality traits and characteristics that I have actually aligned to a career in sales. So maybe sales found me rather than me finding sales, perhaps. That's not too cheesy, Simon. If you'll indulge me with that little bit of cheese.
That's great. And how, from back in the early 90s selling AS400s to migrating into a career in cyber, how did that go about?
So I had 5 years at IBM, and then I moved into Microsoft. Spent 9 years or so, nearly 9 years, working in Microsoft as a client director. So I was working with enterprise organizations, some global organizations, but dealing with all aspects of their IT requirements, everything from the data center through to the desktop. Naturally, there was an element of cybersecurity in what I was doing. But I, after 9 years in Microsoft and 5 years at IBM, I'd worked in industry behemoths, and I wanted to move more into the world of startup type technologies. And through part of my work at Microsoft, I'd started to engage with some smaller ISV organizations that were working in that space. And I just had an affinity to cybersecurity. I really enjoyed the aspects of cybersecurity in terms of the fact that it's an organization actively competing with an adversary. I was fascinated with the geopolitical aspects of cybersecurity, fascinated with the criminal element of cybersecurity. And so I landed an opportunity to actually join LogRhythm in 2011. And that was as a salesperson. My eyes were open to all things cyber. You know, LogRhythm, in terms of being a SIM solution, really sits at the heart of the SOC. And even though in 2011, the landscape was completely different to what it is today, and obviously that whole industry was developing massively as well, I really found a niche. I found a niche that I really enjoy in terms of cybersecurity, and I guess I've had the pleasure and the fortune to work with an amazing number of customers over the last 12 years in helping them improve their security posture. And you know, many of the customers that I've worked with, you know, over that time period, you know, we're still working with. And it's still got, you know, some of those relationships transcend into personal relationships, but also team members in the space. So, so the thing I love about cybersecurity is the pace at which it moves, the innovation that's taking place in that whole area. And as I say, and the fact that it is so essential to the fabric of society, every single one of us now is so intertwined with technology. There's a real personal stake in helping protect the lives of citizens and employees, but also from a family perspective, you know, helping to ensure that everybody can be safe digitally and online. So, yeah, so it's a great space to be in. And if anybody that's watching this podcast perhaps isn't in cybersecurity but is interested in it, I would wholeheartedly recommend it as a space and as an area to get into, because it's certainly been fascinating and exciting and frankly rewarding.
Yeah, do you know, it's interesting you say that, because as you know, and people that listen to this podcast are aware, in my day job, when I'm not doing this, I run a cybersecurity headhunting firm, and I've been pretty much since, I mean, I've been headhunting since 1997. All of that was within technology, but really since kind of 2002, 2003, I really kind of doubled down and focused on cyber. I mean, it wasn't called cyber back then. I think we just sort of called it security or IT security or maybe network security. But what really drew me to it first of all was the kind of James Bondian sort of aspect of it, right? But also the more I got into it, for me, and as a headhunter, I could really headhunt in any sector, right? It doesn't have to be cyber. It could really be anything, right? It's very transferable. But what keeps me in cyber and what keeps me really interested in this is very much what you were saying. First of all, that it does move and change, and there's always something new and interesting, whether it's a threat or whether it's a technology that's countering that threat. So there's almost this kind of innovation on both sides that keeps it fresh and keeps it interesting, right? And stuff that the industry is talking about today wasn't even thought of, say, 2 years ago. And we haven't even thought yet of what we're going to be talking about in 2 years' time. So I find that really interesting. But even more than that is, I think this is probably, except maybe, I don't know, maybe there are a couple of other areas, but certainly this is the only one I can think of where you're really on the side of the angels against the devils, right? It really is a case of, like when we were back in school in the playground, we were playing goodies versus baddies. This really is, you know, the heroes against the villains. And, you know, you and everyone in the industry and me on in a secondary level are working for the good guys. You know, we're working for the Avengers against Thanos, you know? And I find is incredibly inspiring. It helps me get out of bed in the morning and do what I do. And I suspect you and your team, you know, it's that same kind of thing. You know, you really are. If you and your colleagues, you know, laid down your arms for a few days, then there'd be a lot more bad stuff happening.
You're absolutely right. And I love the analogy of Thanos and the Avengers or James Bond, because it does have that element to it. And that is a thrilling aspect of what we do. And I get a massive buzz when I meet with customers and I meet with our business partners that are using our software, and I'm sat down with the practitioners and either helping them or learning from them around how they're applying the technology to protect their organizations from attack. Because it is, I mean, I know it sounds dramatic, what I'm about to say in terms of positioning it this way, but it genuinely is an arms race. Mm. It genuinely is a titanic struggle. And if I think about the conflicts, the physical conflicts that take place around the world, those kind of kinetic type conflicts, they've totally moved into the world of cyber and digital, and to have that dimension to it. And you know, and I see no real deceleration in that. I think the more societies transform digitally and the more reliance that we have on technology, the greater the attack surface for an adversary that is politically motivated to try and take on a nation state and create damage and disruption. But equally, the financial rewards are astronomical for cyber criminals that, you know, to attack organizations and either hold them to ransom or steal information or disrupt their business processes or steal money from them from some kind of fraudulent scheme, and it just, that cycle is continuing. And so it's great to be part of the community, and I do think, you know, all of us play a part in that, and clearly you're playing a part in that with what you do in helping individuals, you know, move into roles where they can add value to you know, to their vendor organizations and ultimately their customers. So
thank you.
Long may it continue, Simon.
Cheers. Thank you, I appreciate that. So but let's talk about another aspect of your career, which is for the last several years you've been working, okay, right now at Logrhythm, and prior to particularly at TrapX, where you were responsible for growing a non-European business in Europe, okay? And I'd really like to kind of understand some of the challenges that you faced in doing it, and then how you have helped those organizations, you know, be successful in Europe. Because I think it's fair to say that particularly, and this almost sounds like a truism, but a lot of truisms are true, is that a lot of American organizations, and I speak as someone that is a Brit living in America and has done very happily for 10 years, don't necessarily understand the complexity and the regional disparity that exists within Europe, much the same way that a lot of Europeans don't understand that America has its own rich tapestry of difference. Okay, so talk me through, if you would, some of the primary challenges either you've experienced yourself or you've seen or heard from other colleagues when they've tried to take an American organization and grow it in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, you're right in your in how you position and explain the dynamics of launching a business in Europe and the nature of American companies that want to do that. And I think it's quite common for organizations, you know, when they're in a venture stage or even in a later stage, to obviously want to conquer the various different parts of the European marketplace. And I've been part of that, and I've led that. And I've also seen it. The majority of my career in thinking about it, now that you've asked that question, has been spent working for American companies and representing American companies in Europe. And, you know, there are differences. There are differences. And I don't want to make a generalization, although I'm probably at risk of making a generalization, but and I'll give an example as well of what I'm about to explain. So buying or selling technology in the US is very, very different to buying and selling technology in Europe and in the
respect.
UK for that matter.
In what
well
respect?
In the respect of the attitudes and the mindsets from a customer, generally speaking, are very, very different. I'll give you an example. I often will participate and attend sales calls, and I have attended sales calls for years where they're in global organizations. And we have a stakeholder in the US who's very excited about the capability of the technology and actually, in a sense, wants to be sold to and buys into the benefit of what it can deliver and is opportunistic in an entrepreneurial as a mindset in that America, in that kind of enterprising in that sense in America. And that, you know, that is often, again, I know it runs a risk of being generalized, but that's often the nature of the mindset of business in America. And I know that doing business in New York is different to doing business in New Orleans, which is in turn different to doing business in San Francisco. But broadly speaking, taking into account the regional differences, that's the mindset. They transform that to the UK as an example, where generally speaking, in the UK, we are conservative, small c, and quite skeptical and quite sometimes dour and suspicious at times of the technology proposition, maybe cynical at times. So you have that dynamic. And then in Europe, in different countries, you have very different tendencies when it comes to purchasing technology. Some parts of Europe, a proof of value or proof of concept is absolutely essential. It's essential that the technicians actually get their hands on the technology and test it, you know, almost with, you know, without wanting to really have any kind of sales type interaction. In other parts of Europe, you have a very process-driven approach, a very methodical approach to doing business. So I say that, Simon, in the context that there are these uniqueness. And when it comes to an American company, it's, you know, wanting to launch in Europe, what counts for success in the United States is not necessarily going to drive the same success across, you know, even in the UK, let alone the rest of Europe. It's not a, to use an American term, it's not a cookie cutter approach. They have to take into account the regional differences. And I've seen it time and time again, and I've witnessed it and I've experienced it. The other consideration that I think is important to really understand is the cultural differences that exist across the across Europe. I mean, Europe, you know, is and again, I'm not saying for one second that the US is homogenous, okay, but Europe is a patchwork of cultures and countries and languages and networks and different types of relationships, and so that makes it very challenging when it comes to being able to engage with customers across the different regions and to be able to launch technologies in those regions and so forth. And then even the dynamic of how to build out your business and how to support your business in Europe, the regulations that exist from an employee standpoint in Europe, very, very different to North America. A lot of employee protection rights of varying degrees across the entirety of Europe that have to be taken into account. There's a lot to consider in terms of an American organization deciding to launch their technology proposition and launch their business in Europe.
Okay, so I want to dig in that in a little more in just a minute, but something that occurred to me as you were describing that was that for the longest time, my sort of focus was help before I moved here was helping American companies grow and develop in Europe. That was very much what my and my company's calling card was. Okay, and certainly for the predominant period that I was doing that, the natural choice for an American company to set up a beachhead was the UK. Okay, they'd come into the UK, and typically it would be right. We'll hire our first sales guy. We may call him VP EMEA. We may not. We may stick a sales engineer alongside him. And if people aren't sure what a sales engineer is, listen to the conversation I had with Sean Blankhorn. They would start off with that beachhead in the UK, and then from there go on to Germany to cover the what's known as the DACH region, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and then maybe France to be a beachhead into Southern Europe, and maybe go to Stockholm to do the Nordics, right? Post-Brexit, do you see that having had to have changed? Or maybe to put a slightly different spin on it, what, if any, impact has Brexit had on how organizations are coming from the US to Europe?
In my experience, and again, I'm not just saying this as a citizen of the United Kingdom, but from my experience, I think there's still a tremendous amount of advantage in a US organization launching their business in Europe, initially in the UK, clearly from a language standpoint, but also from a cultural affinity as well. Not to mention the fact that the UK still represents a significant marketplace for organizations in terms of private sector opportunity, but also public sector opportunity. And London remains, even in a post-Brexit world, really a capital, if not the capital, of financial services organizations in the globe. It's a predominant center for financial services organization and a significant sector. And it's a mature market when it comes to cybersecurity with some good, solid advantages in terms of skill sets, capability, people, and so forth. What's interesting to me from a Brexit standpoint, and I won't get on a soapbox, Simon, about the whole you mentioned Brexit and the wound was nearly healed, Simon.
it's been seven years.
I know. It's 7 years, and yeah. But actually, despite some of the travel disruption that exists and some of the additional checks that have to happen that never used to happen, you know, in terms of traveling around Europe and so forth. And I travel frequently across really all parts of Europe. I've not perceived or seen any kind of limitation for an organization to be headquartered from a European standpoint in the UK and then doing business across the rest of Europe. There's obviously for software companies, there's distribution channels that can be established, which obviously help with that for anybody that is potentially, you know, shipping hardware or logistics or requiring logistics capability and administrative functions and so forth. There's third party organizations that can help support the employment of individuals in countries where perhaps there's not a business entity that's been created. So there's a whole vehicle of supporting functions that can help an organization really establish that footprint in other countries. But from a business standpoint, I've not seen any limitation in there. And I think the advantages of being in the UK outweigh the disadvantages. Now, having said that, I do think it's critical that organizations hire talent in the regions that they're prioritizing across Europe. So of course you can run the business and lead the business out of the UK, having established a beachhead, a solid business in the UK and, you know, capturing that marketplace. But if you want to succeed in France, you'd better have French people in the team and in the organization. And if you want to succeed in Germany, you need to ensure that you've got German nationals as part of the team and so forth, and expand out that way. Because the culture, the network, the relationships, the commitment that shows to organizations as to the seriousness of the organization's intent of being in that country and being part of the fabric is important. I know that organizations will sometimes establish a beachhead and think that, you know, think or operate initially from a perspective of, well, you know, we'll run everything out of the, you know, out of the UK, and we'll have, you know, we'll have sales teams and, you know, fly from, you know, from London to Stockholm, as you say, to Berlin, to, you know, to Munich, to Barcelona, and I'll cover all of that. And in a startup phase, you have to be nimble and you have to be opportunistic to a degree. And there's always going to be an element of building out that business and doing that. But as you get to a phase and as you look at making investments in key regions, having there genuinely is, again, my opinion, others may argue differently, but from my perspective, there really is no substitute for having that local team on the ground that can travel to and meet with customers and the prospects and attend the events and are familiar with those cultural references and the cultural aspects of the business. So it's then a question of strategic, because clearly an organization, you can't be everywhere, right? You know, I mean, you got to place some bets in terms of which geographies you're gonna concentrate and focus on. And I suppose the other aspect that I've seen, experienced as well, and have had others, and this is perhaps more of a cautionary note for those organizations that are looking to do it, is, the product has to have a global fit, right? You know, if the product and the solution that you're seeking to launch in Europe isn't really addressing a problem, it's a global problem, that's, you know, that that's gonna Wow, that's gonna create some challenges, I think, for any team that you actually place into the European operation. So that global fit is important. And I think the other aspect to it is the nature of inflated expectations around what can be achieved within a time frame from a business standpoint, particularly for really early stage organizations and companies where perhaps the proposition itself is novel or relatively new. I talk from personal experience of my time at Trapex. So deception-based cybersecurity technology, hot honeypots have been around for forever in cybersecurity, but nobody had really taken the concept of industrializing them and enabling them to be deployed widely across an enterprise organization to be able to detect and trap and learn from what the adversary was doing and to be able to manage that at scale. Well, it was, you know, as a sector, that's what Trapex and other companies were conceived to do. The classic cybersecurity startup story of an organization being conceived in Tel Aviv and getting the initial funding, seed funding in Tel Aviv to take Series A capital from the US and Israel, and then for the go-to-market to be, right, it's in the US, we're launching in the US, now we're going to take it into Europe. But of course, it's that hype cycle, and this hyping the technology. But it still involves a massive amount of evangelizing and grabbing budgets from other areas to get success and leveraging the network. So, I was recently at our InfoSec event speaking to a colleague from another organization. I'd worked closely with him when he was a business partner at Logarithm a few years ago. And he's launching a niche technology into the European marketplace. And just, again, he's marveling at just how much evangelizing he has to do in a space that's not yet mainstream. And so I think that presents an interesting dynamic between the board of directors that have authorized the investment, the ELT members or the founders of the business that really want to take it to market and see it be successful, that may have achieved some level of success in the America and believe that they can just flick a switch and that the same thing will happen in Europe and it can take longer, particularly in some of the continental European countries. So that's another important consideration, I think, for organizations when they're really thinking about the business plan and perhaps work very closely with whoever the individual is that's going to be leading the European business to set ambitious targets and growth targets and drive it forward, but with that realism and understanding that only somebody that's been doing feet on the street doing this sort of activity can really bring to the table in terms of their experience.
Right. So from your own experience and from your own perspective, how much more complex and how much more sort of challenging or difficult is it to be managing assuming the numbers of people you're managing is the same? So let's say you're managing 5-10 salespeople, okay? How much more complex is it to do that where they're all living and covering one country, say the UK, versus they're covering EMEA wide? So you've got, you know, a guy in France, a guy in Spain, a guy in, you know, Stockholm, wherever, right? How much more complex is it to run a European team versus running a national team?
It's certainly more nuanced in terms of running a team that's geographically split. If you're running a national team in the UK, then the ability to get everybody together, to be able to interface more regularly with individuals, there's clearly more opportunity to do it. The UK, as you know, it's not that big a country. Certainly not. We're not talking when compared to America or the rest of Europe. So there's a proximity aspect to running a team locally and nationally in the UK, you know, that doesn't easily exist across Europe. You know, to get to France, it's a flight, or it's a train. To get to Germany, it's a flight, you know, and to spend the team. So clearly technology helps in terms of the application that we're using now, helps bring people together. And, you know, I think it's really, really important to be able to understand the different dynamics and different perspectives of each of the individuals that you have in the team, and what they're dealing with from a territory standpoint. And that's probably universally true. You know, but I think from a coaching standpoint, in terms of the day-to-day coaching and the activities, I certainly don't perceive differences between, you know, coaching different team members, you know, from a nationality perspective. But certainly there's subtleties in terms of understanding, you know, how business is conducted in, say, Germany, or in Lithuania, or, you know, France versus the UK. So it's important to be, you know, to be appreciative of some of these regional differences, and to be, you know, to be able to offer advice and guidance around those areas as well. You know, but at the end of the day, Simon, you know, the sales team members, you know, tend to share some characteristics, with variation, obviously, for personality and for individual. Most salespeople in my experience, at least most good salespeople in my experience, tend to be self-motivated, driven, curious, hungry for success, keen to impress, action orientated. And if you've got those qualities, if you've got those characteristics in an individual, whether they're in, you know, in Norway, or whether they're in, you know, in Greece or Spain, then that's a lot of goodness to be able to work with in supporting and helping them make. Be successful.
And it's interesting, because I mean, we could really kind of dig down into the weeds and talk about things that are very kind of cyber specific. For example, you know, the different sort of go-to-market strategies that are more kind of traditional in Germany versus Spain, or, you know, the fact that, you know, you really need a distributor and a channel partner to drive business in the DACH region, where in the UK it may not necessarily be as necessary, and that kind of thing. But rather than kind of really kind of getting down into the weeds on that, I think it's the point you're making is really kind of accurate and true, that irrespective of the industry, whether it's cyber or whether it's anything technology or otherwise, it behooves whoever's leading the charge in Europe to know whatever those regional differences are. You and I could talk forever about the regional differences in cyber, but people who are listening to this that aren't in cyber, there are still going to be regional differences in how business is conducted in whatever their industry is, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, coming back to the kind of a central question of when you ask the question, I mean, that is the I think probably a key takeaway for, you know, for anybody listening to the podcast, that's, you know, that's an entrepreneur or a founder of a business contemplating, you know, launching in Europe, is just to be appreciative of those subtleties, of those differences, and to be mindful of it when considering where best to, you know, to launch their business, and where to locate it, where to headquarter it. You know, and the hiring of, you know, obviously what you do in terms of helping those individuals, that the hiring of the talent, whether it is the first people on the ground, or whether it is, you know, building out and scaling up team, that is so, so vital. That is such an incredibly critical component of success for any organization to get that absolutely right in terms of the DNA and of the team members and the qualities and the experiences and the attitude, because as we all know, getting it wrong can create a significant amount of churn and disruption for the business. Certainly see scenarios where organizations do go through that rapid cycle of changing people and personnel and so forth, a stop start. And so having getting that right, trying to get that right and trying to nail that from the outset, I think is really, really important for anyone considering developing the business across Europe, for sure.
Right. Okay, great. So with that in mind, what would you say are your kind of three top tips or primary pieces of advice you'd give to someone or to an organization that are considering establishing themselves in Europe?
I would absolutely, my top tip would be to, if assuming this organization is American, US-centric and US-headquartered, but I'd absolutely pick the UK to be the benchmark territory to land in Europe, and to capture the UK marketplace as far as they can successfully. So that would be tip number one. Tip number two would be to really carefully consider the expansion from the UK into the rest of Europe. Make a couple of bets in terms of the next years to go after, and do that in a considered way with both a multi-channel strategy in terms of working with both marketing and colleagues in marketing to build out the proposition and to get some cycles and some awareness of interest of the company in those key geos, whilst at the same time seeking to partner with a key distributor and other lighthouse partners in those key geos that can really help accelerate the go-to-market activities in that country. And then the third piece of advice would be to, when making those bets and making those strategic bets in terms of the geos and the countries that they're working with, to ensure that they're really deeply looking at the talent pool in that country and the individuals that could at the appropriate time come on board into that geo to really take it forward and help accelerate it, given everything that I've previously said around the cultural requirements and the regional requirements. Make sure you've got those individuals lined up that are warm, ready to come on board to really catapult that success moving forward. So I think those would be the three, the kind of three immediate tips that I'd give to anybody that's really considering this evolution of their business.
Right. Okay. So tell me about Logrhythm and what's next for Logrhythm and for you moving forward.
Well, there are very exciting times at Logrhythm. Logrhythm is continuing to evolve massively and at a rapid rate. 15 months ago. About 15 months ago, nearly 18 months ago, actually, a new CEO came on board, a gentleman called Chris O'Malley. And Chris is really passionate about success for customers and ensuring that all of the employees in the organization are motivated and are extremely focused on helping our customers be successful with our technology, and really thinking about ways in which we can improve our business for the betterment of those customers and serving those customers. And so the last 18 months has been really a complete whirlwind in terms of how we've been re-engineering our business. We are on the cusp in October of our sixth consecutive quarter of promises made, promises kept, where we've gone to the marketplace to tell them exactly what functionality and capabilities we're releasing across all of our products that they can take advantage of. And that's really important, again, for some of the reasons that we were talking about earlier on, Simon, because, you know, the cybersecurity world moves really, really quickly and at pace, both in terms of the tactics and the techniques that adversaries employ, but also in terms of the way in which technology is changing and organizations are constantly changing as well. So for us as an organization to be able to say to our customers and prospective customers, we're constantly thinking ahead in terms of what's going to be needed. And as a business, we've got the correct methodologies internally to conceive those ideas and translate them into features and functionality that you absolutely can take advantage of, and you can bank on us releasing that capability, I think is a really powerful message for us to make. And that was very much driven by our CEO. So that's really, really exciting. But in parallel to that, we launched in June in the UK, our cloud native SIM platform. It's called Axon. And as in neural networks and axons and nerves and all of those sorts of things. And it's proving to be really popular. It's taking the 20 years of heritage that we have as an organization in terms of our understanding of log management and log analytics and correlation and capabilities that organizations need from a SIM perspective. And it's reimagined all of that for the cloud. And for organizations that are on a digital transformation journey, or for organizations that are even conceived and born in the cloud, this ability that Axon has to be able to ingest really any type of cloud or on-premise data, and then to make it such easily available and readily available to an analyst or a user to be able to understand what's happening across their organization is very, very powerful. And so that's massively exciting. As a business, we continue to grow, which is obviously great, but we won't rest on our laurels. And we're hugely appreciative of the customers that have, you know, made their bet and made their investment in Logrhythm technology. And we really want to ensure that we can continue to serve those customers like we have been doing for the last 20 years. So exciting times in summary, Simon, at Logrhythm. And business growth continue. And, you know, and with that comes obviously growth from a team perspective. So, which is, you know, personally exciting for me. I'm keen to continue to build out the business and keen to build out the team and really help the team be successful. So
great stuff. And if people wanted to reach out to you or learn more about you or Logrhythm, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can contact me via LinkedIn. It's probably the easiest way to do it. I'm happy to provide my email address as well as part of this. The kevin.ely@logrhythm.com is probably the easiest way. And as I say, in LinkedIn, but all more than happy to be contacted and to help anybody that's interested in getting into cyber.
Fantastic. I'll make sure your link is in the show notes below. Kev, thank you so much. This was amazing. It was such a journey from the US to Europe and just kind of understanding more about the complexities and the regional differences and the challenges of building European business and what to look out for and how to address it has been a real joy. So it's been great hanging out with you. So Kev Ely, thank you so much for joining me here in the conference room.
Thank you for inviting me, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up next week on The Conference Room, I'll be talking to tax and investment specialist, Suhei Piedra.
I have a client who was making $75,000 a year, you know, now owns 12 properties, is able to retire early because the majority of them are paid off, and not by him, but by rental income that he used because he still had his regular job. So he didn't change his lifestyle. Right? He still lived off of his $75,000 W-2, whatever he was, you know, earning. And then these real estate properties just paid themselves off.
Thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it. And make sure you visit our website, theconferenceroompodcast.com, to see all the other episodes and to get access to the show notes and resources mentioned in this episode. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your network, or better still, go on to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or any other podcast platform and leave us a 5-star review. It'll only take you a moment, but it'll mean the world to us. And please don't hesitate to tell us which topics you'd like us to cover in future episodes. To get in touch, drop us a line in the comments section or send us a message on social media. Just search for The Conference Room Podcast or me, Simon Lader, on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or TikTok. I'm always open to a conversation. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you'll be alerted when a new episode goes live every week. Thanks so much for listening to The Conference Room, and until next time, keep talking.